From Tribune Tower, WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything that's in the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this week's edition of the Sunday Spin for May the 28th, 2017. I hope you're having a good and reflective Memorial Day weekend. This is our weekly look at the politics and policies that shape Chicago, the state, and Washington, D.C. So time to grab the Sunday paper, get that hot cup of coffee, and we'll try to get your day and your week off to a terrific start. Well, I bet you guys didn't know that, I didn't even realize this, today is National Hamburger Day?
I didn't know that.
I mean...
National Hamburger Day.
National Hamburger Day. Max Armstrong, our friend, tweeted that out this morning, and I didn't know that.
You know what this means now.
What's that?
Breakfast at the Goat. And not an egg sandwich either.
Double cheese.
Right, Sam? Are you with me?
What time? They open at 9.
Yeah. See?
We'll be on an extended break for a little while. Well, I thought it was ironic because down the street here on North Michigan Avenue is Michael Jordan's Steakhouse, and they've been doing a burger of the day each day for the month. Yesterday's burger, the Madigan versus Rauner. Seriously.
The Madigan versus Rauner.
Burger, yes. And here's the description, okay? Completely full of it.
Ah!
Bacon, pulled pork, sliced ham, cheddar, American cheese, lettuce, tomato, onion, pickles, mushrooms, jalapenos, mustard, and special sauce.
And a $100 bill.
Yeah, well, and I don't even want to know what the special sauce is for the Madigan
versus... Was there a sesame seed bun involved here?
Yeah, nothing on the side, but yes. That would be a $100 bill in an envelope is how you pay that bill for the Madigan versus Rauner burger. Oh, man. You can't get away from it anywhere.
It's a National Hamburger Day.
National Hamburger Day. I guess,
I like,
you know,
this.
With the holiday and everything, that kind of makes some sense.
I wonder when all this got started. This is the first I've heard of it.
I don't know the history of it.
Yeah.
I'm sure you have more resources than I in the newsroom to figure that
just
out.
Just get a hold of Max and find out.
Yeah, that's probably the best idea. But, yeah, I mean, you know, it's kind of the kickoff to summer and get the grills going and those kinds of things. So... and hopefully the rain will stay away for a while. No, tomorrow.
Well, we have thunderstorms actually reported in Rockford right now.
Oh, really? So
yes.
It's moving in.
So it is kind of moving in this direction, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Well, hopefully it'll be an early wave, and then maybe we can enjoy some. I mean, it's a beautiful, sunshiny day down here on Michigan Avenue here in the Allstate Showcase studio. And you could tell, you know, it's that time of year because so many tourists are back in the city. It's just kind of unbelievable. And you, I ran into a couple from Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, that were in town. I thanked them for
Saskatoon.
Well, I said, where are you from? And they said Saskatoon. I said, oh, Saskatoon, Saskatchewan. And they said, you're the first person that we met that knew it was, you know. But that's a long way to go.
That is a long way. Did they drive? Do you know? Or
no, they flew.
They did. That's still a long way.
Yeah, but they wanted to come in and they watched some baseball. They got to. See, I thank them for bringing the Canadian weather that we were having. but they said actually when they left Saskatoon, it was warmer there than it was in Chicago. So hopefully...
What does that tell you?
Yeah, well, hopefully we get these temperatures rebounding and everything as it should be, because those 50s are just miserable.
Yeah, I think going into this week now, the middle of the week, upper 60s, but I was looking at 70s and upper 70s perhaps at this time next week. So I think we might have turned the corner.
Well, and of course, you know, here we are, we get that lakefront breeze off the lake.
Oh, yes.
It's going to get out in the 70s in the western suburbs today, but they're still saying like mid-50s here downtown. So
I couldn't believe the number of people that I saw at the North Avenue Beach when I was driving down Lakeshore Drive yesterday.
They were
out there.
Yeah, well, and frankly, you know, when the sun is out, it does feel warm.
It does, because the sun is warm. The air is still cool, but
right.
There were plenty of people out there at North Avenue and Oak Street when I was I went through there middle of the afternoon yesterday. And lifeguards in duty, everything in place.
It's the end of May, dang it. It should be warm.
That's right.
It should be warm.
That's right. All they needed was 10 or 15 degrees warmer air.
And don't go in the water.
And right. Yeah, do not go in the water.
I mean, I can only imagine what the water temperature is still got to be. I don't even know if it's at 50 yet.
Upper 40s.
Yeah. So, no thank you.
Still a polar plunge in May.
Yeah, no thank you. No thank you. And, of course, end of May, as Sam had on the sports, we're moving into the Stanley Cup Finals on tomorrow night.
Final. Don't say finals.
Okay.
Remember, the hockey people come at you.
Yeah, well.
NBA Finals, Stanley Cup Final.
I don't care.
I got your back here.
I appreciate that, but the bottom line is... the ones who are going to come after me, I've been watching hockey longer than they've been alive. So
fair enough.
Tough enough. And besides, my Ottawa Senators aren't in it. And my adopted NHL playoff team, double overtime in a game 7 against Pittsburgh.
It's a heartbreaker.
You know, and
I texted you too. I felt
yes,
bad. I was like, damn it.
I appreciated it too.
So who are you rooting for now?
I don't think you like either team, do you?
I'm not crazy about either team. Mm. I do like P.K. Subban, defenseman for Nashville. I think he's a great kind of new generation of hockey. And although I heard from my friends from Saskatoon, they weren't so high on P.K. Subban, which is, of course, why Montreal traded him to Nashville. But I think I'm going to have to go with the Preds. The NASCAR Preds, as I call them. Pittsburgh, they're a gutty team. They're trying to do a back-to-back, which hasn't been done since, I think, the Red Wings did it a decade ago, especially in the salary cap era.
Oh, 19 years now, I think.
Okay, 2 decades ago.
Yeah.
So, that's pretty impressive in and of itself, but... yeah, I think I'll have to go with Nashville, as much as it pains me to say that. But the Preds, the Ottawa Senators, they gave it a great run. And, you know, there's nothing more exciting than a Game 7, except a Game 7 that goes to overtime, and then a Game 7 that goes to double overtime. But it is sudden death. And when that goal is scored, that's it. You know, that's the end of a season. That's the end of a long run. And it's just, it's just so sudden and heart-stopping that, it's over. It's done. And you think of the entire season that, you know, was passed. And in less than 6 minutes into double overtime, that's the end of your season. Pack it up. Goodbye. You're done. It is heart-stopping to watch. But I enjoy it just immensely. But now we move on to the final, and we'll start that on Monday. I was surprised the NBA is waiting till Thursday to kick off the NBA final.
I think it's sweeps week for television, so they need to get all their shows through the finale. I think like Dancing with the Stars is the finale, or that was last week.
Yeah, they had that already.
But they're going through like the end of the shows here in May, so the NBA kind of takes a back seat to that, and then once those shows are over... then the NBA takes over.
So, well...
what television controlling everything.
Well, yeah. I mean, well, that's where the money is. That's what keeps these leagues operating.
Yep.
So that'll be... And frankly, with the NBA, it came down to what everybody expected it was going to be anyway. I mean, Cleveland, Golden State. I mean, it's like, why play the season? Why not just go ahead and have the finals?
Meanwhile, hockey, you have Game 2, Game 3. They'll both be on the NBC Sports Network. They don't even get the head billing
no,
on
I know.
NBC. So hopefully you have cable to watch the Stanley Cup Final. You need the NBC Sports Network.
Well, that was the case with the Blackhawks a few years ago, too. The NHL Final. I've learned something here from you, Sam. The Final.
Final.
Thank you.
Hockey
but
people will fight you, Swanee.
Okay.
They will fight
I don't want to get into an argument.
Drop the
you.
S. You better drop that S.
But I remember watching the Final with the Blackhawks a few years ago. It was on the NBC Sports Network.
Yeah.
It wasn't really on the regular network in prime time. So
That's how they treat hockey.
There
what
you
can
go.
What can I say? Don't say the puck drops either. You know, the puck drops at what time? Don't, because the hockey people come after.
They don't like that either?
No. It's a face-off.
I see that in our sports write-ups all the time.
I said it too.
I know. I say it all the time. I mean, that's, you know, come on.
Well, don't we say first pitch in baseball? You know, the first pitch at such and such a time.
Yeah. I don't have a problem with it. I'm not, you know, I enjoy the sport, but I'm not going to go crazy about you can't say certain things about it. Yeah. No. Enjoy the sport, not the lexicon. How about that? There's a bumper sticker for today.
I cannot repeat the bumper sticker I saw yesterday.
Yeah?
It's about...
can you hint at it?
Not really.
Okay, then why'd you bring it up?
Because you were talking about bumper stickers.
Because now everybody's going to scratch their head.
No, how can I phrase this?
I've got my finger on the panic button.
Thank you. You know, you've seen the stickers on various buses and trucks saying, "How's my driving? Call 800.
Right.
Well, this one said, "How's my driving? Call 1-800 and then fill in the blank."
It
was just like saying, "Well, if you don't like my driving, that's
tough.
Too bad."
Yeah. Tough.
I cannot use the phrase that they used on the bumper sticker.
Ah, isn't it great, this time of civility that we live in? I mean, it's just, you gotta love it. Well, Dave's here to keep us up to date on all the news. And civility. Sam's here with all the sports and civility. Producer Jasmine is here to field your phone calls at 312-981-7200. That's our text line as well, 312-981-7200. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin. We're on Twitter at @SundaySpin. And engineer Bob is checking out the ads for grills in the Sunday paper so he can celebrate National Hamburger Day properly. Don't forget, if you have to tune away, you can always find our shows on WGNRadio.com, and you can also get our podcast at iTunes by searching for Rick Pearson. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll launch our spin of the national political scene. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Welcome back to The Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase Studio in Tribune Tower on North Michigan Avenue. It's time for our weekly spin through national politics. And while Donald Trump spent the week traveling, there were still plenty of travails for the president and the allegations of collusion between his campaign and the Russians, including his son-in-law and senior White House advisor, Jared Kushner. The Washington Post reported this weekend that Kushner and Russia's ambassador to Washington, Sergei Kislyak, discussed the potential of creating a secret and secure communications channel between the Trump presidential transition team and the Kremlin, using Russian diplomatic facilities as a possible shield from being monitored. This came during early December meeting at Trump Tower. The meeting also was attended by Michael Flynn. He's the national security advisor that Donald Trump was forced to fire. Now, last week, former CIA Director John Brennan, who served from 2013 to 2017, he was on Capitol Hill, and on Tuesday, he explained why he believed the issue of Russian interference in our election process was so important for everyday Americans to understand.
Our ability to choose our elected leaders as we see fit is, I believe, an inalienable right that we must protect with all of our resources and all of our authority and power. And the fact that the Russians tried to influence that election so that the will of the American people was not going to be realized by that election, I find outrageous and something that we need to, with every last ounce of devotion to this country, resist and to try to act to prevent further instances of that. And so, therefore, I believe that this is something that's critically important to every American. It's certainly, it's very important to me, for my children and grandchildren, to make sure that never again will a foreign country try to influence and interfere in the foundation stone of this country.
Now, at this congressional hearing, Brennan was asked what he discovered as CIA director about interactions between the Trump campaign and Russian actors.
I encountered and am aware of information and intelligence that revealed contacts and interactions between Russian officials and U.S. persons involved in the Trump campaign that I was concerned about because of known Russian efforts to suborn such individuals. And it raised questions in my mind, again, whether or not the Russians were able to gain the cooperation of those individuals. I don't know whether or not such collusion, that's your term, such collusion existed. I don't know. But I know that there was a sufficient basis of information and intelligence that required further investigation by the Bureau to determine whether or not U.S. persons were actively conspiring, colluding with Russian officials.
That's former CIA Director John Brennan. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Up ahead on The Sunday Spin, we'll be speaking to my Tribune colleague, Monique Garcia. She's on the Tribune's political team and is our State House Bureau correspondent. We'll be talking about the latest from Springfield as lawmakers near their scheduled May 31st adjournment of the spring legislative session on Wednesday. That's ahead.
Now, The Sunday Spin continues on 720 WGN. Here's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning. Happy Memorial Day holiday weekend. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and this is your Sunday Spin. Continuing some of our spin through national politics, while the president was away, he returned last night after his nine-day trip. But while he was away, Republican Senator John McCain of Arizona asked the president's national intelligence director, former Indiana Senator Dan Coats, about Trump asking the intelligence community to push back against the FBI's Russia investigation. Here's what the National Intelligence Director had to say.
Director Coats, according to the Washington Post story this morning, President Trump asked two of the nation's top intelligence officials in March to help him push back against an FBI investigation into possible coordination between his campaign and the Russian government. According to current and former officials, Trump made separate appeals to the Director of National Intelligence, Daniel Coats, and to Admiral Michael S. Rogers, the Director of the NSA, urging them to publicly deny the existence of any evidence of collusion during the 2016 elections. Coats and Rogers refused to comply with the request, which they both deemed to be inappropriate. Yeah. Is that an accurate reporting, Director Coats?
Mr. Chairman, as the President's principal intelligence advisor, I'm fortunate to be able and need to spend a significant amount of time with the President discussing national security interest and intelligence as it relates to those interests. We discuss a number of topics on a very regular basis. I have always believed that given the nature of my position and the information in which we share, it's not appropriate for me to comment publicly on any of that. So on this topic, as well as other topics, I don't feel it's appropriate to characterize discussions and conversations with the president.
So as you could plainly hear, no response. Meanwhile, continued focus on former National Security Advisor, Lieutenant General Michael Flynn. Much of the multiple investigations focusing on Flynn's relationship with the Russians. Even New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, a top Trump transition advisor, said Flynn didn't belong anywhere near the White House.
You know, listen, I think I said earlier, I think I got asked this by George Stephanopoulos, I think, was the first time I commented on this. I think it's safe to say that General Flynn and I didn't see eye to eye. I didn't think that he was someone who would bring benefit to the president or to the administration. And I made that very clear to candidate Trump, and I made it very clear to President-elect Trump. That was my opinion, my view. Do I feel vindicated? I don't have any need to feel vindicated one way or another, Charlie. You make recommendations, you do the best you can to make recommendations to a president-elect. In that context, I did. But I would just say this to you. If I were president-elect of the United States, I wouldn't let General Flynn in the White House, let alone give him a job.
That's New Jersey Governor Chris Christie speaking to ABC News. Well, we're going to switch gears now and take our conversation down to Springfield. And joining me on the phone is my great Tribune colleague and State House Bureau Chief for the Chicago Tribune. It's Monique Garcia. Welcome, and thanks for getting up with us this morning.
Good morning. It's great to be able to chat with you.
Oh, come on. You're only saying that to be nice. This is kind of one of these weekends where we do it so you don't have to, because the Illinois House will be in session this afternoon. They'll be back after their brief little holiday respite. Illinois Senate comes back on Monday, all looking ahead to May 31st and the scheduled adjournment date, which here we go. It's Groundhog Day all over again.
Indeed. It seems almost like we're careening towards a brick wall again.
Yes, exactly. Except it doesn't hurt anymore. Except it just hurts all the providers of services that are, you know, the social service safety net that just keeps crumbling away. We have, you know, when lawmakers were last in session, we had the Senate Democrats pass their proposal for a $37.3 billion budget that includes $5.4 billion in income tax increases, expanded sales tax, taxing streaming, video streaming, and video services, all on Democratic votes, and now sends that package over to the House. We've got House Appropriations Committee's meeting this afternoon. As you kind of put it, they'll be picking that apart. What should we expect today?
Well, I think that we're going to see them really kind of go into the nitty-gritty of this spending plan. So for several months, Democrats have, in a very public nature, been trying to work with the Republican colleagues in the Senate to come up with some kind of budget agreement that, you know, has fallen apart several times, spectacularly last week when Democrats said, you know, we're sick of trying to wait, get the GOP on board. We're going to go it alone. Meanwhile, while the eyes were on the Senate, the House, privately, Democrats have been meeting for weeks, if not months, to come up with their own plan. So they very much have a good idea of, you know, the issues at hand, how big the budget hole is, and kind of the votes that would be to try to get out. But they say, you know, we don't want to just outright dismiss all of the hard work that our colleagues in the Senate did. So we'll have people from universities come in, we'll have some social service providers come in, and we'll go down and get into the nitty-gritty of it and see if it can work. Now, we know that privately Democrats voted on this plan in caucus before they left town Friday, and there was a general lack of support. So the question now is whether or not do we work with this framework the Senate sent us and try to tweak some things to try to build support, or, you know, do we put up something of our own on the board this week and have these kind of two dueling plans, which we've seen Democrats do frequently in the last several years.
Well, I was looking at the story that we wrote a year ago. And it was kind of back then it was a day of anger, and it was Democrats in the House and Democrats in the Senate were angry with each other. Republicans were even more angry at the Democrats than usual. I mean, it was, you know, it was those tensions that were building. And so here we have the Senate, which, you know, for years has kind of had to either take or leave what the House Democrats do under Speaker Madigan with a budget proposal. And now you have the Democrats in the Senate that are actually moving things forward. But given the great uncertainty about what the House Democrats plan to do, I was still very surprised that President John Cullerton and Senate Democrats would move on their own on a plan, taking some very politically risky votes here. And, you know, without knowing what Madigan and House Democrats are going to do, and you may have these members. Now, granted, I'm not sure how many of them are necessarily that politically vulnerable, but certainly they're going to catch some heat to vote for, you know, this kind of very sizable income tax increase.
Right, and those are discussions that they had internally amongst themselves for a very long time, but they're a building and growing frustration of some rank and file members who want to be able to go home and tell people in the district they did something. You know, they argue that it hadn't been good enough to say no and to say, look, we're really trying to protect you in the face of something the governor wants that we don't support ideologically. They say that is no longer enough and we need to at least be able to say we tried. There's a view that no matter what they do, the governor and Republicans are going to come for them come election season, which we're already seeing now. So they say, you know, why not? Why don't we try to be your chamber? Why don't we try to set an example and show our colleagues in the House that you can make these tough votes when required?
We're speaking to my Tribune colleague, Monique Garcia. She's the State House Bureau Chief for the Chicago Tribune in Springfield. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase Studio in Tribune Tower on North Michigan Avenue. Joining me on the phone is my Tribune colleague, Monique Garcia, State House Bureau Chief for the Chicago Tribune. You know, Monique, we were talking right before the break about, you know, the Senate, basically Senate Democrats feeling, well, they're going to come after us anyway. You know, we'll try to be the adults in the room and move this process along. But I'm not sure that that gets you, you know, politically, I'm not sure that that gets you anywhere.
Right. And that is the concern that we're actually seeing more of in the House, where there are members who are a little bit more vulnerable. In fact, we saw this week the governor pulling in some rank and file House Democrats who are targets into his office. And our understanding of his conversations is that he warned them, you know, like, you can be in trouble if you vote for this Senate bill as is, which raises taxes and doesn't have a property tax freeze in it as he has called for. So there very much is a sense that this can come back to bite them, particularly if they take these votes and no budget actually becomes law. So they take these really tough votes and also on a budget that does include cuts, but they don't actually fix the problem. And so it's going to be really difficult to find a way forward here, particularly as we get closer and closer to election season and people really worry about being just painted with that broad brush of having voted for a tax increase.
Well, and as you noted on Friday, there was a closed-door caucus meeting of the House Democrats. 42 of the 60 votes that would be necessary, 42 of them said that they could vote for this tax increase. But there is still that belief that if there's going to be some blame tossed around, that it needs to be blame on both a pox on both your houses kind of thing, a pox Republicans and Democrats as well.
Right. And Speaker Madigan has for many years insisted that if there is going to be a vote to increase revenue, that there has to be Republican votes on this. He fully recognizes it wants to just expose Democratic members to the criticism. And indeed, people on both sides of the aisle have said very loudly for several years that it is going to take a tax hike and cuts and some other tweaking to make this work. But there seems to be just a lack for people to really come to an agreement on how to do that.
So today we have hearings on the Senate plan, but yet there's still kind of this fundamental belief of, you know, the unknown. What's next? Is it going to be a House full year budget? Is it going to just be a stopgap budget? Where does education fall into this? Because, you know, we're seeing schools around the state, despite the fact that, you know, the appropriations increased for K through 12 education, these schools are owed $1 billion in backlog bills. Where do we go forward?
Well, that is the multi-billion dollar question here, and there doesn't seem to be a consensus on how to proceed. So we have the House picking apart the Senate budget today. They do have some committees again scheduled for tomorrow where it looks like they might have some bills they can pop on an amendment to update with their perhaps their budget proposal. But it's really unknown kind of, you know, where all of these pieces are going to land at the end of the day. And do Democrats, will they be able to agree between the chambers and get a budget on the governor's desk? And then if they do, what happens if he vetoes it, which he did his first year in office, except, of course, for K through 12 education? Or do we see something that happened last year where the chambers weren't able to agree, a spending plan did not go to Rauner, and they came back in June facing that July 1st start of the new fiscal year, and they created this temporary six-month spending plan, which, as you know, expired back in January, and schools and universities and social services have gone without funding during that whole time. So there's a whole host of questions that still remain out there, and it's causing a lot of nausea and, quite frankly, a lot of weariness among lawmakers and among schools and among social service providers who've gone through this process for what is now the third year in a row.
Well, in our story in today's Tribune, we also note the fact about not only did the Senate, you know, approve this income tax increase that would move the personal rate from 3.75 to 4.95, almost where it was previously. But under the nature of the way that the Senate Democrats did it, it would have made it retroactive to January 1st, which means that the effective tax rate, the amount being withheld from paychecks, would be even greater to try to catch up for the time that has elapsed. And that's something that has created some consternation among Democrats in the House as well.
Absolutely. Greg Harris, the representative from Chicago who is leading these budget talks, said there's, you know, almost no support in his caucus to make that retroactive because it would be such a painful hit for people's paychecks. That said, there are also some within his wing, within the Democratic Party, who are pushing for an even higher tax rate, who say that, you know, that 4.95% sounds nice because it means we're below the 5% that was in place when Governor Quinn was in office. But that really, to dig us out of the hole properly, we need to probably go above 5%. We've seen that from some of these independent fiscal watchdogs who've studied this and said that, you know, 4.95 to do it. But again, as noted earlier, there is an unwillingness to make that vote and to be put on the record as saying that you're willing to take more money out of taxpayers' pockets.
Well, and of course, we've seen the ramping up of Republican Governor Bruce Rauner's demand that a property tax freeze be part is the latest precondition for any kind of a package, and that obviously the Senate Democratic plan did not contain any kind of a freeze. I don't get any sense that the House Democrats are going to move towards one either.
Right. They're very clear in that, you know, that is something that sounds good. They compare it almost to like that word association game. When you hear Bruce Rauner, what do you want to think of? Well, he wants you to think it's property tax freezes because it sounds good if you just look at it at the surface level. But they note that property taxes are where they are because a lot of local towns rely on it for police and firefighter pensions or just day-to-day operations. And, of course, school districts rely on that money because they aren't currently getting enough funding from the state. So they worry about, you know, kind of the unintended consequences of doing that kind of freeze. And they note that, you know, we're not sure if we gave him a freeze, if that would be enough anyway. He has kind of had this shifting list of demands that he wants as part of a budget package, and it changes sometimes from day to day or week to week or year to year. And they're not convinced that if they give him that freeze, that he'll actually go along with the budget anyway. There's a lot of mistrust here, and nobody really seems to be willing to take each other at their word.
Mistrust, as we are already rapidly accelerated into the 2018 election season, not only for the race for governor, but also in the legislative contest with the state Republican Party, which is heavily funded by the governor, using robocalls to in some of those districts of House Democrats, warning them of the consequences if they vote for that Senate Democratic package. Monique Garcia, State House Bureau Chief for the Chicago Tribune, thank you so much for joining me this morning. Go back to sleep, and then because that way you won't fall asleep during those hearings this afternoon at 2 o'clock.
It'll be a struggle either way.
Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
We'll be back with more right after this.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning and welcome to the second hour of your Sunday Spin for this Memorial Day holiday Sunday. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase studio and a sunny North Michigan Avenue so far, but as Dave warned, be prepared for some bouts of rain and perhaps thunderstorms later today. But get out and enjoy the day while you can, and hopefully if there are storms, they'll blow right through and we'll get back into our holiday kind of temperature. I want to pick up on some of the national spin here for just a moment. And we were talking about the issues of the president returning from his foreign trip and the problems with Michael Flynn, who was terminated as his national security advisor. And we know that Flynn and his businesses have been subpoenaed by Congress. We know that Flynn has said he wouldn't testify before Congress and would plead the Fifth unless he got immunity. And immunity has not seemed to be anything forthcoming. Well, pleading the Fifth, let's go back to the 2016 presidential campaign. And I want you to remember what Donald Trump said about those taking the Fifth after he criticized those who did it during the Hillary Clinton email probe.
Here's people taking the Fifth Amendment. Four people plus the guy who illegally did the server. You know, he put in the illegal server. So there are five people taking the Fifth Amendment, like you see on the mob, right? You see the mob takes the Fifth. If you're innocent, why are you taking the Fifth Amendment?
If you're innocent, why are you taking the Fifth Amendment? And then during his foreign trip, the president went to Israel, where he met with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. And now remember, this was going to be an interesting meeting, since Trump had reportedly given the Russian foreign minister and Russian ambassador intelligence that was so secret that our allies didn't even get it. And it reportedly came from Israel. So what does Trump do?
I never mentioned the word or the name Israel. Never mentioned it during that conversation. They were all saying I did. So you had another story wrong. Never mentioned the word Israel.
Intelligence cooperation.
Okay, guys. Thank you.
So there you have it. You have basically the, in a public setting, the president confirming that the intelligence came from Israel. Well, joining me now to talk more about the travails of Donald Trump is Pat Brady, and Pat is the former Illinois State Republican chairman, and he's with Next Generation Strategies. Pat, thanks for joining me this morning.
Good morning. Hey, Rick, I just want to tell you, I brought you some new listeners. My golf group at Tamarack is listening to the morning spin.
A shout out to the folks at Tamarack.
Shout out to them, and speak quietly while they're putting.
Well, I hope they get 18 in before the rain comes. Part of the reason I wanted to have you on is in your past life, you were an assistant U.S. attorney, did white-collar kind of crimes. And I don't want to get ahead of things. And in fact, that may be a problem in all of this as we look at the whole issue surrounding Donald Trump. But nevertheless, when you look at kind of the things that have been revealed, it does raise issues about a pattern and practice that could be construed as obstruction of justice to some. I'm not sure, is there a lot of leeway that defines obstruction of justice?
Well, obstruction of justice is very, I think it's 1503, Title 18, 1503, is very broad in impeding the proper functioning of administration of justice. It's a very broad statute. And if you take a step back on all this, the Russia connections, the alleged collusion, those are very serious matters that need to be investigated. But to me, the bigger threat to the Trump White House is the obstruction, the trying to influence people within the administration to stop the investigation, the firing of Jim Comey, the way they did it. That, to me, opens up the door for some type of obstruction investigation. But another thing, that this may be too much into the weeds, but right now we have a special counsel that the Justice Department appointed, Robert Mueller, who is investigating a criminal investigation into these Russia connections, which is going to stop a lot of this congressional inquiry. Because like you're talking about immunity, remember Oliver North, when they gave him immunity and ultimately ended up reversing his criminal conviction, because once you give somebody immunity,
right,
you can't, it's very, very complex. But the point is, there's an open criminal investigation right now, which I think is going to slow down a lot of the congressional political investigations. We may not know a lot of this for a long, long time. This Russia investigation, to me, is very complicated. The obstruction, less complicated, but the Russia investigation, very complicated. It's going to take a long time.
Well, and, you know, we also have the president doesn't really help himself in his statements and comments. I mean, go back through the whole Comey firing issue, and, you know, you hear four different versions until he tells Lester Holt on NBC News, well, yeah, it was about the Russian thing.
To me, I watched the Lester Holt interview, and I go, well, he just admitted to obstruction, because it was not yet defined whether or not he said he fired Comey because of the conduct during the Hillary Clinton email investigation, which a lot of us that were prosecutors or people in law had questions with how he handled that.
Sure.
You got to remember, he's the FBI director. He does not make the prosecutorial decision.
Correct.
That's Loretta Lynch, but he did a press conference anyway, and he used that as a pretext or a ruse to fire the FBI director, knowing full well he's under investigation. It's just kind of outrageous conduct.
Well, and then you had the White House citing, Rob Rosenstein, who is the deputy attorney general, and because Jeff Sessions, the attorney general, allegedly recusing himself from consideration of these matters.
Allegedly.
Well, I only say that because after Rosenstein's letter citing, you know, what Rosenstein said was not appropriate conduct in the Hillary matter, and then you have Sessions saying, yeah, go ahead and get rid of him.
Which was created at the request of the president.
Right.
Rosenstein got his revenge, though, in appointing Robert Mueller to be special counsel for the Justice Department. But the whole timeline, if you look at it, yeah, could you make arguably a case for obstruction? I think you could. I think that's the biggest threat to the White House.
Well, speaking of Comey and Hillary Clinton, you know, now we have these reports that Comey came out and made this unusual declaration that
twice
the investigation was done and there was no prosecution, based on the fact of his belief that there was phony Russian intelligence of a phony email that didn't exist with Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who was then the DNC chair, basically telling George Soros, the mega Democratic funder, that the Justice Department is slow walking this Hillary thing, and it's not going to lead anywhere. That never happened. There was no email, but Comey was so worried about allegedly, the reputation of the Justice Department, that he felt he had to get out in front of this and basically declare no prosecution, anything, without even consulting then-Attorney General Loretta Lynch.
Or investigating, or actually looking at the alleged email, just relying on triple hearsay to ascribe motives to the Attorney General. He could have just gone across the street. Say, what are you doing with this? They do that all the time. They should be talking all the time. But, you know, it didn't help matters, and I'm not sure exactly on the timing of the memo versus when the former president of the United States walks across the tarmac at Phoenix Airport.
Correct.
To meet with Loretta Lynch right about the time she's making a decision on whether or not to charge his wife, or charge his wife with something relating to the email investigation. So it gets kind of muddled, but all that aside, when the president of the United States knows there's an active and open investigation of his administration and maybe even him, to say, hey, you're fired, it's Nixonian. I mean, can you imagine if we knew that there was an investigation by the police superintendent of Rahm Emanuel and he turned around and fired the police superintendent? The place would blow up. But that's the kind of conduct that we've seen out of President Trump in this regard.
We're speaking with Pat Brady, former state Republican chairman. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. Figured we should play some Allman Brothers and remember Greg Allman, who passed away at 69, and Allman Brothers music, I'll tell
you. Good stuff.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, that's what's great about summer in Illinois. There are a lot of smaller places you can go see some of the old great bands. I saw Boston Tuesday night in Springfield. It's fun to go. They're great places to go. And
Were they at the convention center?
Yeah.
They fill it?
Pretty much, yeah. And the setup's so nice. Everything's real easily accessible. You walk right to your seats. The bathroom's right there. If you want a beer, it's right there. It's really fun.
We're speaking with Pat Brady. He's the former state Republican chairman. He's with Next Generation Strategies.
And a man of the 70s, if I can remember all that.
Well, I actually remember seeing Tony Bennett down in Springfield. Drew 300 people. That was it.
You know how much it costs to get in for a corporate gig?
No. But this was a regular concert in Springfield.
300?
That's all he drew was 300. I was so embarrassed, you know.
Did you have good seats?
Well, you bet. Actually, Governor Edgar was in front of me. And when he started singing, you know, it's 2 a.m, there's no one in the place, I was translating it for the governor. So. Because I knew he wouldn't
He's
quite.
He's in bed well before that.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Well, Pat and I are talking about the kind of the potential legal difficulties that the Trump administration faces. And as we've seen reports that the presidency is creating basically a legal war room, which I think does kind of reflect what might lie ahead. And, you know, with Robert Mueller as the special counsel, he has wide latitude, too.
Oh, yeah, he's just like, he's the Justice Department. And when you get a grand jury subpoena going and start subpoenaing things like tax returns, you're going to find out a lot of information. And these investigations, as we know historically, Whitewater started as a bad land deal and ended up the president getting in trouble for lying under oath about sex with his intern. So they never end up where they started. So this is bad news for the White House. But I do have to say one thing. And maybe this goes into some of the, obviously present company excluded, but I was watching the cable news shows Friday night when they're talking about Jared Kushner being involved somehow in this investigation, or the FBI wanted to talk to him, and they blew it up into some big, huge story, which, of course, they're going to talk to him. He was part of the campaign. He's close to the president. That doesn't mean necessarily that he did anything wrong. Even with the phone line, we don't know. The point is, there's so much hysteria around this right now. I think people need to take a deep breath and let the investigation take its process, and we'll find, or go through the process, and we'll find out what happened.
I mean, and you know, you go back to the Watergate days, and obviously the different technology, different time, different. We didn't have CNN. We didn't have social media. We didn't have. But, you know, Watergate took. It was a drip, drip, drip kind of process.
Yeah, but what.
We're just seeing it.
I had the Tribune every day. That's all we had. And the news at 5 o'clock and 6 o'clock or whenever it was on. But now, Friday night, I was watching some of the cable shows. They were just going crazy on this little development, which is really meaningless. And it feeds this. It feeds into Trump's argument all the time that he's being treated unfairly. Whether you agree or disagree, you hear that and you're like, I wish everybody just take a deep breath.
Well, there was one thing about the Kushner involvement with the so-called back channel trying to create that is that would have been ostensibly that was early December. So that would have been a couple of months after, you know, there's already been a warning
right.
that the Russians were trying to influence.
No, if that's true, and he did, it is bad, and it is, it could be really bad.
I mean, just given just the timing of it, and again, you know, so much of, as I said, that Trump hurts himself,
yes.
and it's things like optics. It's kind of like, you know, you have a story break about Trump and Russia, and then the next day. Who's in the White House? The Russians. Or, frankly, Henry Kissinger. I mean, it's like...
Didn't Nixon do that? Didn't he back channel in 68 to tell the South Vietnamese not to cut a deal because they'd get a better deal when he became president?
Well, that's...
And that's
yes.
the same kind of... I don't think there's a comparison here, but it was interesting that it had been done before.
Well, and the other thing about Kushner, too, is there's the concerns about sanctions and...
The Crimea...
Yes, yeah. The Crimean sanctions.
Which he affirmed this on his foreign trip.
Sure, but as well as a bank that you know had the potential to be doing business with the Trump organization for as a source of money for further development. So,
well, you know, and this maybe goes back to, and I obviously was not a supporter or a big fan of Donald Trump when he ran. This rhetoric or this behavior is so far removed from what conservative Republicans have typically done. Most Republican presidents didn't want anything to do with the Russians other than tell them to get out of Crimea and quit being bullies. And no, we're not going to put up with it.
And be very hawkish.
Very hawkish. And that's always been our position. So this warming up to a guy like Putin, I still don't understand. This country was on the verge of falling into the ocean not too many years ago. And,
right.
and Putin's actually reestablished them on the world stage through some of our missteps. But I don't understand why you would just not do anything but just buckle down on them.
So when you see some of these, you know, leading Republicans, I mean, it's got to be kind of a tearing situation because, you know, you want to support a president of your own party, but at the same time, you know, you look at the Speaker of the House saying, "No, I don't think Jim Comey's a nut job,"
or even the former Speaker calling Trump basically a disaster. John Boehner said that.
Yes. Oh, well, yes, right. And that he's quite happy and does not want to be president of the United States.
Yes.
But, you know, is there a point where Republicans are going to have to walk away? Depending on how this plays out.
It depends on how it plays out. They've won the special elections that
right.
were two of the three, and there's one coming up in Georgia. So the Republicans aren't losing race, although they're closer than they should have been. But maybe an answer, too, is the more that the Democrats put Hillary Clinton out there to speak, there's nothing that motivates Republicans more than Hillary Clinton giving a speech. And the speech she gave at Wellesley at her commencement, that motivates Republicans. So to answer your question, I don't think we're there yet, but keep putting Hillary Clinton out there, and I think we'll be okay.
That's Pat Brady, the former state Republican chairman of Illinois, and with the Next Generation Strategies. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN. Up ahead on your Sunday Spin, we'll be speaking to Bob Secker. He's my former Tribune colleague who's now Director of Investigations for the Better Government Association, the BGA.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Welcome back to the Sunday Spin on this beautiful Sunday, holiday Sunday morning. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Showcase Studio and Tribune Tower on North Michigan Avenue. And joining me here in studio is my good friend Bob Secker. Bob's my former Tribune colleague, former cellmate, I guess you might kind of call it.
Yes,
and right. he's director of investigations for the BGA, the Better Government Association. Thank you for getting up this morning.
Oh, thank you for making it later than usual.
I did that especially for you. I wanted you in because there have been a couple of stories that the BGA has done as we move back and talk about the great Springfield budget impasse. A couple of things. One, I think, was kind of almost a updating of something that we had done earlier. And we talk about the state's huge pension debt, $130 billion in debt. And we have the court rulings that basically say there isn't much we can do. Now, there's a Senate-passed bill that the House may take up that Senate President John Cullerton believes is constitutional. I think there's still a lot of questions because it's based on a footnote in an earlier ruling.
Right.
But nevertheless, there are limits to what can be done because under the state constitution, you can, once a pension is granted, basically through work, you can't diminish or impair it.
Correct.
And in the story that came out of the BGA was the fact that, are there abuses of the system?
Sure. There are abuses of the system. You know, if I go back, I think it was, and if I'm misquoting him, I apologize, but I think it was Jim Thompson when he was governor who liked to say, people talk about waste, fraud, and abuse like it's a line item in the budget you can just cut out. It's difficult to find these abuses, and there's also some very, very large pensions which are legal but irksome to a lot of people. But when you actually look at the totality of the pensions, which is what we did, you find that those really big, supersized pensions don't amount, or they amount to a fraction of the overall cost. So if you somehow could do something about them, you would solve very little.
And, you know, part of this issue with pensions is really the fact when the legislature decided that there would be that 3% annual cost of living adjustment, which frankly outpaces, you know, as we've seen, inflation or the cost of living.
Sure. That was, you know, and that was back in 1990, I think it was. And, you know, you can go back and, you know, hindsight is great. You can't, under the Constitution and under the Supreme Court ruling, you cannot reduce that, even though the legislature tried a few years ago. And that's what produced the Supreme Court ruling to begin with. It said, no, 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 you can't do that. But, you know, again, it's, I don't want to sound flip about it, but it's so what? We know what the costs are. We know what we owe. And it is actually, it's very expensive to fix that, but it's not because of the 3% COLA. It's because the Illinois legislature and governors, in their wisdom, going back prior to World War II, never put much money into the system for the employer share of the benefits. And that mounts up over time. And that's why we have this huge overhang of pension debt.
Sure, because it's the day of reckoning. It's right. The kicking the can down the road, as it were. And it's and frankly, you know, those people who started this on this road, they're not around anymore.
Correct.
And it's and they weren't going to be up for election or anything else. And we had this continued underfunding of the employer's share. And so you do have those that are working for government that are retirees. They paid their share.
Correct.
And but yet you want to cut.
Yeah. And, you know, and if you have to go back, just again, harken back to that diminished and impaired clause in the state constitution, that was put in there back at the time. And the chief sponsors of that were all Republicans. And they were worried because they were implementing a new state constitution in 1970. And the existing case law at that time said that pensions were the term they used was gratuity, which meant that the employees could pay their share of the pensions. And if the state or the municipalities or whoever it was that ran the pensions so decided, they could just yank them away. So that was put in there to protect that.
Well, and so you have various groups espouse, well, let's just have everybody go into a 401k plan. And that isn't how the system works, because those contributions wouldn't then go into the pensions.
Well, I mean, there's a few things about that. You know, if you could go back in time and redo it, it might make sense to do that. But remember, in 1970, when the state constitution was written, 401ks didn't exist. It was either Social Security or a pension, and the state, long before that, by and large, not totally, but by and large, decided that they were better off keeping people in pensions. And one reason for that, I mean, ironically, is that if you go in the Social Security system, it's a hard cost. Right now, it's 6.25% of a paycheck is the employee share, and the employer share is similar. It was less back in 1970. But you can't skip out on that like the state did on the pensions. So, you know, we would have, over time, had to pay a lot into the Social Security system, and there was no getting around it.
And right now, there is no Social Security.
Yes.
And that's for the public employees, the teachers,
right.
I mean, most notably, that there is no Social Security benefit attached to that. So the state does not have to make that hard cost.
Yes. Yeah.
But now we have created this other Tier 2 system for new employees in 2011, which finds itself at risk because the benefits it may pay out may not meet the test that you can skip.
Yes.
Social Security.
Going down, it'll take many, many years for that to trigger in, but that is a possibility. And the other thing about Tier 2 is it's disadvantageous to the employees. I mean, the reality is that if you're an employee, it's a kind of a bad deal. You have to pay as much as the older employees, the Tier 1 employees.
But get less in return.
But get less in return. And you probably would be better off if you just took your money and, you know, stuck it under a mattress or something. But that's
really
that's an exaggeration. But we're stuck with that system. And the other thing that's so weird about this push for more 401ks is that if you start moving people out of the pension system, if you could. You start moving them out of the pension system, put them in a 401k, then you've got both the employee and the employer not paying into the pension system, yet you have this huge overhang of debt, so the original pension system gets worse, not better.
And, I mean, and truly, the pension cost, when you're looking at state government and its ability to have flexibility in spending, when you look at a quarter of the revenue the general fund revenue is just going to pay the pension debt.
Absolutely. And the, you know, it's a shame. It's a shame. There's no cheap way to get around this. And that's kind of the problem with all the solutions right now, is we are still trying to figure out how to cheap it out. And we can't. You know, the Supreme Court says you can't. And rather than deal with the problem head on, we're trying to find all sorts of ways to avoid dealing with the problem that the legislature and past governors created in the first place.
And, yeah, there is no easy way out. Mm-hmm. And we're going to follow up on that.
Sure.
But, well, and quite frankly, you know, the BGA also did a story about the issue of, you know, it's easy to say cut, but it's actually very difficult.
Yeah, and one of the reason is because the big areas you can cut, you know, you can't cut the pensions, and that's a big chunk of money. You don't want to cut schools, and even though you kind of de facto are, because the bills are just not, the school districts are just kind of losing, and now
they're
being
owed $1 billion.
Yeah, and now the governor wants to freeze property taxes, which is the main engine for school revenue. But you've got a state workforce that is significantly shrunken from what it was 15 years ago. You know, we're down about 20,000 or so.
Well, I believe we rank as among
the states with the lowest per capita. We are the lowest. And then the other thing is, you know, Medicaid, which is a big cost, but we pay far less than the national norm per recipient. We have a lot of recipients, so the overall cost is high, But a lot of that is also paid for by the federal government. So I know there's one group closely aligned with the governor that says we can save money by just eliminating the Obamacare Medicaid expansion, and that might be done for us by people in Washington. But there's a cost to that. The government right now, the federal government, pays 90. It was 100. I think it's 95 now. But if you have people start flooding emergency rooms or just getting really sick until they really need very expensive emergency care, you undermine yourself. And so you gotta think these things through before you just, hit some ideological buzzword button and go
ahead.
Well,
and as, we all know, preventative cost is less expensive than after the fact cost.
Sure. Go back to the pension problem. If we had been preventative in the first place, we wouldn't have this problem.
That's Bob Sector, Director of Investigations for the Better Government Association. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, the Chicago Tribune, joined by Bob Sector, Director of Investigations for the Better Government Association. We're kind of talking about some of the, basically we created the setup for, here we go into the final scheduled days of the Illinois legislature for spring. And as I spoke with my colleague Monique Garcia earlier, it's Groundhog Day all over again. Not really that much closer to ending this 22-month, I believe, now. I've lost track of the numbers of
coming
months.
Coming on 23, yeah.
Of that the state of Illinois has not had an operating budget. Mm-hmm. In the meantime, we're overspending to the tune of $11 million a day. The bill backlog, I believe State Comptroller Susana Mendoza says, which is over $14 billion right now, just the normal backlog of bills, probably closer will be $16 billion when we get to the end of the state's budget year at the end of June. We've seen the posturing going on. We've got the full campaign mode going on for 2018 already. Mm-hmm. And I think that just has, that has just thrown in the towel on anything.
Yeah, and, I'm bad at predicting things, but I would be willing to bet that come Wednesday, which is the last day of the regular session, there won't be any budget for the fiscal year coming up. That doesn't mean they can't reach one before the fiscal year begins, but it's not looking good.
No, because I think, in my view, politics has overtaken things. You have the governor who has spent the last few days pushing this idea of a property tax freeze.
Let me just say something about that, because it's really interesting. I mean, this is property taxes. Everybody hates their property tax bill. They are, in most places, enormously high, and you could see why that would be a very good political message. The problem is what he's proposing is horrific public policy, and it's the kind of public policy that got us into the soup with pensions. There's a picture on the Tribune website of the governor in Orland Park with some woman holding up her very high property tax bill. And I went and looked. I didn't know exactly what address she had in Orland Park, but in Orland Park, either depending on where she lives, either 60% of her property tax bills is schools. Or 69%, again, depending where you live. So if you want to freeze taxes, you are freezing school spending because the state isn't coming up with much more. And that is, to solve the property tax problem, you have to solve the school funding problem. And that, unfortunately, is going to take a lot more state taxes. The reason our property taxes are high, it's by design. The Illinois legislature, in its wisdom, has long decided that rather than do what most other states do and pick up 40%, 50%, 60% of local school cost, we've knocked it down to 26% or 25%. And so that's why your property tax bill is high. So, you know, if you want to...
Well, in fact, her bill would be kind of almost on average with the, what the state average is that 67% of school funding is done through property taxes, 25% through state funding.
Right.
And so, and you're right, and there's the issue of the double whammy for these schools because, okay, if you're going to constrain and constrict their property tax revenue... Now, the governor's plan says, well, if voters want to vote to increase or decrease, they could do it through an easy referendum.
Well, referendums aren't easy, and you can't do them every time, you know, every next week. There's only, you know, like essentially once a year or once every 2 years you can do it. So that's kind of a false premise.
But if you think the property tax increase that the Senate Democrats passed to go to 4.95% is onerous, to truly change things around to provide that majority share of school funding from the state would require a vast, vast increase.
Well, you know, the irony here is that the last time we revisited this issue in Illinois was in 1997. And then Governor Jim Edgar, Republican Governor Jim Edgar, wanted to do what was called a tax swap. He wanted to raise the state income tax, use some of that for school funding, and most of it for property tax relief. The plan was blocked by his own Republican colleagues in the state Senate, and because they didn't want to raise the state income tax. And ironically, what the increase he was proposing was to take it to 3.75%, which is exactly where we stand today.
Well, and no, I mean, there's a great history of that concept of the tax swap. Mm-hmm. Quite frankly, I'm curious to see if that isn't something that comes out of some of the Democratic candidates for governor when they talk about the onerous property tax system. Mm-hmm. But for the Republican governor, just by using property taxes, as I have in the Sunday paper, it's also a launch pad because this way he can – that takes in the conversation of – House Speaker Michael Madigan, his chief nemesis, who also is a property tax assessment attorney.
Yes.
He takes in Joe Berrios, who's the Cook County Democratic assessor, as Cook County assessor, as well as Cook County Democratic chairman. And then it also, you can toss in the controversy over J.B. Pritzker's assessment reduction as well. So it's a multiple bird-killing stone for...
Just remember, this is a guy who ran for governor in 2014 complaining that both Democrats and Republicans in Springfield spent all their time worrying about the next election, and what they needed to do is make the hard choices to govern. In his first year as governor, the Supreme Court cut the legs out from under him and said, no, you can't reduce... You can't cut state pensions. And ever since, he's essentially been campaigning for re-election.
Well, and we see the ads. And we see the ads on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. And it's from an offshoot of the National Republican Governors Association. It's frankly a tax-exempt group that's running them. So we don't know who's even funding the ads.
Sure.
Although the governor's campaign people say that they are not.
Well, this is, you know, this is kind of the genesis of the whole 2-year-long standoff. You saw when finally the Senate the other day passed its version of a grand bargain without any Republican votes. Within hours, the ads were up, you know, complaining about the tax increase. And this is the whole thing is gone. The Democrats didn't really want to do that because they wanted Republican votes on his cover, and the Republicans didn't want to do it because they want to be able to attack the Democrats for being high taxers. And that's why we're here.
And thus shall ever be.
Yes.
Bob Sector, Director of Investigations for the Better Government Association, thank you so much for getting up and taking the late shift on the Sunday Spin.
Yeah, I'm doing Dean Show next week.
Very good. We'll be back with more right after this. That's all we have time for on this week's edition of the Sunday Spin. I want to thank my guests, Monique Garcia, State House Bureau Chief for the Chicago Tribune, former state Republican Chairman Pat Brady, and Bob Sector, Director of Investigations for the Better Government Association. Most of all, I want to thank all of you for listening and hope you're going to have a great, enjoyable rest of this holiday weekend, because I know Dean Richard sure is.
Yes, I am. You know what I spent almost all day doing yesterday? Cleaning my grill.
Grill, yes, yes.
You gotta have the grill maintenance. You got to have the grill maintenance.
Well, you get those big fires if you're not careful.
You know? Can burn your house down. Just not the way we recommend that you do pulled pork.
No. Well, low and slow.
Low and slow, not
not
high
and flaming.
not when it's moving over to my house.
So you're cooking today.
I'm all set. You could eat off my grill right now.
There's a first.
That's
no. So what are you making?
I don't know. I haven't decided yet. I'm going to go to the store later and see what strikes me.
Huh?
When I go there. But in the meantime, we've got an action-packed show for you today. A couple of the stars of Pirates of the Caribbean.
Right.
Two Oscar winners, Javier Bardem and Jeffrey Rush, were both featured in the film. We've got the cast of the new Josephine Baker musical that's at the Black Ensemble Theater. That's why we have 400 microphones in the studio right now, because they're going to come in with full band today and
that sounds great.
Perform for us live. We've got Bike the Drive for me to make fun of all morning long.
I'm waiting for this
one. So we've got plenty going on between now and 1 o'clock.